Addictions are so common that they are the new norm. From caffeine to alcohol, smoking to drugs, gambling, and even food itself. It's estimated that at least 70 million Americans are addicted to food. Do you recognize an addiction in your life? Do you want freedom? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Addictions are truly debilitating. Meet Charles. He knew he had a weight problem and dreaded going for his annual physical. So here's what he did first. Watch.
I decided before I even went to the clinic I needed to lose a little weight, so I went on a bit of a crash diet and I lost about 10 or 15 pounds before I went for my annual physical. But at that time I weighed 263 pounds.
This is me 5 years ago at a family reunion. I was at 263 there. That was my 48-inch waist.
When I went to the clinic, I was diagnosed as pre-diabetic. I was hypertensive, and my understanding was I was prone to strokes or heart attack. My cholesterol levels were way out of whack, and there were some other minutiae in there that was not good, just with my blood tests. So I was not a very happy camper. One of the reasons that I had gone is that I was in severe pain with my back. I had a job that required a lot of sitting at that time. I was also doing some home projects and I kind of injured one of my discs, and I had some sciatic issues going on with them and my piriformis muscle. I'm not quite sure what the convergence was of all three of those, but I was walking with a walker and two canes and I was stooped over. I was in a lot of pain. I was taking medications for that pain and eating Advil like it was candy. So when I went to the doctor, to the clinic, and they gave me that diagnosis, the doctor at that time told me that he could begin writing prescriptions for me, for my high blood pressure, for my cholesterol levels. And he, in fact, left me, you know how they do, he kind of left the room for a while and came back in with his prescription pad. And he said, "Charles, I'm really happy to begin writing prescriptions, if that's what you'd like." And he said, "Most men your age," at that time I was 62, he said, "most men your age prefer that I begin to write prescriptions. It's kind of the easy way to go." But he was good enough and kind enough and compassionate enough to turn around on his little swivel chair there in the clinic and put his hands on my knees, look me straight in the eye, and he said, "Charles, everything that I've just told you, you can do something about it, and I don't have to write a single prescription, but you've got to get started." And it was a really powerful moment for me, very powerful. It also coincided, however, with a book that I had been given by a good friend of mine, a naturopathic doctor, and the book was called One Year to Live by Stephen Levine, and it was just an exercise in living your life as though you had 1 year to live.
Would he take the prescriptions or get serious with his health? Find out in the next segment. Today's show is the first in a four-part series on beating addictions that will take you from wanting to winning with Vicki Griffin. You don't want to miss her very personal, very powerful story. We also have a delicious pie for dessert, and we'll learn what happens in the brain during recovery from addiction. But first, the news. In the headlines, happy meals are healthy meals, carbs a new taste sensation, and overweight costs. Happy meal times result in kids eating more fruit and veggies. 74 parents of preschoolers answered two questionnaires over the course of 2 years and had a home visit by researchers to observe the family during mealtime. The study tracked the positive and negative emotions expressed by parents and children. When mealtimes were positive, kids ate, on average, one extra serving of fruit, veggies, or soy. Tips for parents include having set time and place for meals, staying calm under duress, and encouraging kids to use words rather than screams when they're upset. and to include children in food shopping, meal planning, and preparation, like setting the table, made meals more enjoyable. Scientists in Australia claim to have found a new taste sensation that may be contributing to the problem of overeating and obesity. That new sensation is carbohydrates, although it is different to the sweet of sugary carbs. The Deakin University team isolated two complex carbohydrates commonly found in bread, pasta, and rice, and tested 34 individuals for their ability to sense each carbohydrate taste. Energy intake, diet history, weight, and waist circumference were analysed. Individuals who were more sensitive to the carbohydrate tastes ate more of the foods that contained them. They consumed more total calories and had a larger waist circumference than those individuals with lower sensitivity. So if you crave complex carbs, your taste buds might be to blame. Overweight children could one day cost this country dearly. Researchers set out to see how much the obesity epidemic will cost America when our kids grow up. Firstly, they found that being overweight costs a person $30,000 more in healthcare costs for weight-related conditions like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, heart attacks, heart failure, and certain cancers. And that being ill requires more time off work, which costs an additional $45,000 in lost wages compared to someone with normal weight. Physical activity in childhood is strongly linked to childhood weight, which is carried into early adulthood. Analysis of physical activity amongst America's kids aged 8 to 11 predicts over 8 million of them will be obese by 2020 if they do not become more physically active. That's going to cost $2.8 trillion in medical costs and lost wages. Now, if half of our kids exercise 25 minutes 3 days a week, there would be 340,000 fewer overweight and obese youths, with a savings of $22 billion in medical costs and lost wages. Not to mention significantly more joy, fun, and zest for life. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Today's guest is Vicky Griffin, a nutritionist with a special interest in nutrition and cognitive function, brain health, and addictions. And Vicky's not on the outside looking in on addictions. She has her own personal story to tell, which we will hear. But first, let's find out why we are all so prone to addictions.
Well, the roots of addiction, Narada, are tangled and they are deep. And so for different people, there are going to be different reasons. Some of those reasons have to do with liability, genetic liability. Some have to do with environment. There's always a spiritual factor. And there's the environment that calls us in a direction. What may begin as a curiosity can become a compulsion pretty quickly.
That's so true. Now, you know, we're talking about food addictions in this series.
Yes.
What are some of the elements in food that addict us? Or is it the elements?
Well, I think it is a lot of things. We live in a media-saturated society that hyper-focuses on thinness and external looks. We have food that is manufactured to be highly hedonic, highly pleasurable, so there's a lot of chemical wizardry involved. When you take the fiber out of the food, then it creates biologic shifts that affect the brain-body systems and even the gut microflora. So we are making choices because our environment is calling us in a direction. The choices create challenges, the social pressures. So I would say that there are five elements that are a battlefield for the person struggling with an addiction, whether it's a food addiction or any addiction. So it's the environment, that is what surrounds us. It's our culture, and that's what pressures us. It is our biology, and that is what changes us. It's the brain, and that is what drives us. And it's the spiritual, and that is who leads us.
So that's our entire selves, really, isn't it?
It is every aspect of our humanity and our spirituality in this world.
And I guess for some people it may not be the culture, but for most of us that is the case when it comes to food.
There are different elements that are going to be triggers for different people, different vulnerabilities. But I believe that we all need to be vigilant and be able to fight smart on every one of those fronts. The addicted brain is fighting hard, but we need to learn how to fight smart.
Amen. Amen. Now, we all have to eat. So is it possible to break a food addiction? Because we're always going to have food around us.
Yes, that's a very good question. And that may be a key as to why food addictions are one of the hardest to break. We have a pandemic of obesity in the United States and worldwide. We do have food addictions and even new eating disorders that have sprung up. And yes, we're always going to have to eat. Actually, I'd like to say we get to eat. And learning how to crave the good stuff is a science now, not just a natural instinct.
We get to eat. Sounds like a privilege and a responsibility. In the next segment, we'll delve into her story. However, first, consider this. Here, try this.
Oh, thanks. Hey, I saw this health guru on TV eating cardboard.
Cardboard?
Yeah, you know all this health food. It tastes like cardboard.
Very little health food tastes like cardboard. That's a huge myth.
Oh, come on. You know that people eat health food to stay healthy, not because it tastes good.
That's not true, but even if it was, wouldn't it be worth it?
Hey, can I have another piece of
that? Sure.
No, it wouldn't be worth it. I'd rather die young and happy than old and miserable.
Well, me too, but you can have your cake and eat it too.
Cake? Cake? I don't see any cake. Where is it at?
Oh, you've got a one-track mind. I mean, you can die old and happy by eating healthy and tasty food.
Like what?
Well, you've been enjoying what I just gave you.
You mean I'm eating health food right now?
You are.
Oh, what is it?
It's dried banana. No sugar, no preservatives.
Well, actually, to be honest with you, it tastes very, very good.
Well, there you go. So try a variety of healthy foods. Doctor's orders.
Kitchen, and it's one of my favorite recipes I want to share with you. It's a dessert, which we don't do many of, but you know, we all need a little sweet treat every so often. And with me today is Justin. Justin, how you doing?
Hey, it's great to be back.
Good. Hey, we're gonna make lemon velvet pie, and this pie, by the way, is from Becky Griffin's book. She's amazing. She does all kinds of things with her books. This is her recipe book, which she wrote with her daughter. And so she's allowed us to use this recipe and to share it with you, lemon velvet pie. So, Justin, let's find out what the ingredients are, what's
okay.
in this recipe.
Well, it sounds absolutely delicious. For the pie filling, it's a 20-ounce can of pineapple, crushed or chunks in juice, half a cup of water, one medium orange, peeled and diced, 6 tablespoons of corn flour, 6 tablespoons of honey, half a teaspoon of lemon essence, and then 4 to 6 tablespoons of lemon juice and 1 teaspoon of lemon peel.
And if you get more than one
Sounds
teaspoon
good already.
Off there, yeah, right, yeah. If you get more than one teaspoon, we'll just throw it in.
Oh, okay.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
More the merrier.
You can't waste lemon peel.
No,
right?
No.
It's just so yummy. So this is really easy. What we're going to do is just throw everything in the blender. Then we're going to heat it up, thicken it, and pour it into our crust. So get started with the lemon, if you don't mind,
okay.
while I try and manage to put all of this in the blender without it falling on the floor. You know, you want to use pineapple that doesn't have syrup, so go for the pineapple with the juice. And that's really important because, you know, this recipe has a lot of sweetener in anyway with the honey. And if it is too sweet for you, you can cut that down. But you don't want to be adding syrup with the pineapple.
I'm making such a mess with my lemon zest here.
Oh, that's okay.
That's part of the fun.
Well, yeah, it is. And the thing I like about this, I like to, you know, to add value to recipes. So if I'm having dessert, hey, why don't I get some of that nice antioxidant from fresh fruit in here? You know, you've got the lemon, you've got the orange, you've got lots of vitamin C here. So that looks awesome.
Okay.
I might steal that off you.
Some lemon juice here?
And when I say corn flour, I mean corn starch, where I come from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So now the whole world can understand what we're talking about, right? So in goes our beautiful fresh lemon zest.
There's something so satisfying about juicing a citrus.
There is, isn't there? And I love how your hands smell after.
Oh, yes.
So you're going to have lovely lemony hands.
the rest of the day.
Okay. Lemon juice.
Lemon juice. Okay, down the hatch.
Okay.
Right, looks like we are good to go there. Let's blend that up briefly. And you don't have to worry too much about getting that honey all broken up because it's going to melt.
Oh, okay. So you blend it up and then you cook it.
And then we're going to cook it.
Wow, look at that.
And just thicken it because that cornstarch is going to make it nice and thick, so it will set nicely in that pie. Now, you don't have to make this as a pie. You can instead, like we've done today, is turn it into, you know, put it into parfait dishes with some granola underneath and perhaps some yogurt on top. Mm. Or if you don't even want to do that, just make it as a pudding and then,
okay,
you know, people can
just eat it straight out of the pan.
Yeah. And so it becomes a nice, zesty, fresh, you know, topping for different things. So, yeah, that's going to thicken up, and then we will pour it into our crust.
Okay.
But why don't we go ahead and move to tasting?
Oh, yes.
That's, I want to see what you think
of it. My favorite part. Here you go.
Well, thank you. What a gentleman.
Wow.
Isn't he a gentleman?
I'm looking forward to this. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Mmm.
Yeah.
So citrusy. Got that yummy lemony taste. I love it.
And then I've sprinkled coconut on, so the pineapple and the coconut like a bit like a lot of sort of taste. So, well, I'm glad you like it. Thanks to Vicky for a great recipe. Remember, you can find all our recipes on the website hopetv.org/gohealthy. Charles had pre-diabetes, obesity, hypertension, high cholesterol, severe back pain, and depression. A friend gave him a book called 1 Year to Live, which he took literally and spent a year pretending it was his last. Then he headed into the Colorado Rockies and fasted for a week, under the supervision of his naturopathic doctor, of course. Watch what happened next.
When I came off the mountain, the fasting itself just kind of revitalized me. It reinvigorated me. And I didn't start eating my 2 junior bacon cheeseburgers that I like to eat every day. The naturopath had given me kind of a diet that I should use to ease back into my normal eating. And it was primarily around the vegetables, nuts, and fruits. That's how I eased back into my normal eating. That first year after that, though, what I really did is I decreased my portions, the amount of food that I was eating, because I realized that I was just like a garbage disposal. I mean, if it was there, I ate it. And, you know, I have a pretty diverse appetite. So there aren't very many foods that I don't like. But I also knew I was eating too much. So the first year, it was just a matter of me decreasing my portions. And I began to work out. I started doing aerobics more. I didn't have a specific goal in mind, but what I did know is that I didn't want to go on a crash diet. I had done that before. I'd lost a lot of weight, and then I'd gain it all back, and then some more. And it was always a little counterproductive and depressing. Once I started doing that, I started losing weight. And I think the first year I probably lost about 20 pounds. I'm fortunate because I have a sister-in-law and a brother who both work in the medical industry. They're naturopaths, and they have a more holistic approach to things. So I started working a little bit and manipulating my diet, the red meats. For the most part, I completely cut it out of my diet and was really replacing it with just fruits, nuts, vegetables, grains. I began to lose more weight. And as I lost more weight, I was feeling better as I worked out. Just parenthetically, at the end of about a year, I was able to get rid of my canes, get rid of my walkers, and I was on no medications for that. It took a year, but it resolved itself. And over the course of a 4-year period, I lost a total of 103 pounds. I went from 263 down to a low of 157.
just last month at 157 pounds, and I've lost quite a bit of weight. Actually, I've lost a lot of weight.
I have had some weight gain, but it's all related to resistance training and weight training. And I've probably gained about 4 pounds or 6 pounds in muscle. So that's good. I'm happy with that. I'm real happy with that.
I'll be happy too if I can be building muscle in my retirement. Today's guest is nutritionist Vicky Griffin, whose expertise in addiction really began in childhood. Here's why.
Well, I had a sister who was 8 years older than I am. And I was raised in a home that was quite turbulent, in fact, very violent. My father left home when I was younger. My sister was already older and out of the home. And I was left with the violence, and it was pretty unremitting. So I began my experience running away from home quite young. I was 5 the first time that I ran away from home.
Oh my. So tell us a little bit about your parents. Your father was off the scene. Did you ever see him again? Was he not really a part of your life after
Well, that? I did see him on and off. He was in the wine business. He was a very busy busy man, and he did his best, but he, of course, as all of us, we operate with the information and knowledge that we have. My mother was very emotionally ill and unstable. She was extremely violent, and so that was my early childhood. I don't have a recollection of really feeling safe or being in a stable environment. And that affected my outlook on life, and the mindset of a runaway was established in my thinking quite young.
Yes, because as children, we don't have all of those coping mechanisms, and we're dependent on the very person who was instigating
right.
your problem.
I was conditioned to accept some pretty cruel punishment. In those days there wasn't a lot of help, even though the neighbors knew what was going on. No one reached out to help, so the supports weren't there. I did not have a religious foundation that brought me any kind of spiritual security or understanding or knowledge of a good God who can help in situations like that. And so I was basically rudderless in a very scary situation, and I developed an attitude of a person that would want to escape. I just wanted to escape, and I was angry.
Oh, I'm sure you were. And did that anger overflow into other areas of your life?
Well, it did. I just didn't seem to have a recipe for solving problems. And so by the age of 11, I was running away pretty chronically. Ironically, I would hide in libraries.
I was going to ask where you ran away to. At the age of 5, where did you run away?
Oh, across the street.
Across the street, okay.
The cow pasture.
Oh.
But ironically, I would run to libraries and found a safe haven there. I've always kept my grades up and loved books as a result, and I think librarians are amazing people because they keep a perfectly peaceful environment in those in those buildings.
So you sought peace in the midst of chaos.
I did, and I remember at the age of 5, I would climb different trees. I would run across the street and climb different trees with a book, and I would hear the screaming across the street if my sister was being beaten. And I remember one time some cows came, a cow and its baby came to the pasture underneath the tree where I was sitting and weeping, and I saw this mother cow tending to this baby, and I remember thinking, if I had a choice to be like what is across the street or what is here, I choose here. And I believe that God heard that as a prayer, and that circumstances would eventually work out to liberate me and give me a life and a life of ministry.
So you were almost praying to the unknown God in a way.
No, yeah,
yes,
exactly.
That's amazing. Now, you say your father was in the wine business. Was alcohol a factor in your home environment?
I believe that in some respects that it was. I believe that they did not understand certain principles. They didn't understand certain principles of healthful living or of how to treat one another or courtesy or all of the things that I now live by. They just did not know. And they were trying to navigate themselves through life with fierce tempers and unruly habits, and And so I just did not get a skill set for navigating through trouble. And so by age 11, I was seeking to have control in my environment. So by then I had fallen in with a bad crowd and was using drugs and smoking, and I developed an eating disorder. I developed bulimia.
Wow. So yeah. Life was very much turning out of control for
you at that point. It was all about being perfect and getting in control and being thin and feeling better, not being sad and not being afraid. And so I found the mix of drugs and food to chemically induce that state.
And did it help?
It would help momentarily, but it actually fosters more self-preoccupation, more depression. After the immediate gratification comes the loss of control, the loss of self-esteem, the lack of judgment, the vulnerability to being treated cruelly by other people, because that's what you were conditioned for. And so, yes, this was the spiral of my early life, yeah, for quite some time.
Mm. Now, there's an overlap, isn't there, between substance abuse and eating disorders. Why is that?
Well, 75% of people that suffer from addictions of any type have some sort of comorbid or coexisting condition that exists that needs treatment. So people have spiritual problems. They have mental health problems. They have attitudinal problems, social problems, financial problems. These are all issues that are resolvable, that are treatable. If you don't know what those needs are and you can't identify them, just thinking skills, having the thinking skills for navigating through trouble. As I run programs now for addictions and obesity and diabetes and all of these various issues, one of the first things we address are healthy thinking skills and the spiritual tools for achieving those thinking skills, attitudinal skills. These are things that come to some people even naturally, but not to all. And we need them. We all need them. And fortunately, we are engineered for renewal, recovery, and restoration. I am grateful for that every day.
So before the break, let's hone our spiritual skills.
It may seem that food addictions are a modern-day problem. However, they've probably been around for thousands of years, perhaps since the fall of man in the Garden of Eden. King Solomon, the wise man, advised in Proverbs 23:1, "When you sit to dine with a ruler, note well what is before you." He goes on, "Do not crave his delicacies, for that food is deceptive." You might ask, how can food be deceptive? Well, perhaps the food looks good, but it's not good for you. It might harm your health or make you sick. Perhaps the food is really a trap. Food scientists today know how to design food with just enough fat, sugar, and salt to make us come back for more and more and more. It almost seems that their goal is to create food addiction. Would you like to know how to avoid food addictions? King Solomon said, "Know well what is before you." In other words, we should know what's on our plate and in our foods. And the best way to do that is to prepare the food ourselves, to make it simple, nutritious, and unprocessed as possible. Instead of eating potato chips, we could eat a baked potato. I never heard of anyone addicted to such simple, healthy foods. When it comes to food preparation, get as close to the Garden of Eden as possible and take food that the master designer designed.
When it comes to alcoholism, some people argue it's not really a disease, but many addicts need a 12-step program and fellowship to finally achieve abstinence. And here's why. Repeat exposure to an addictive substance, like alcohol, causes the brain to adapt in a way that drives drug-seeking behavior. Therefore, what begins as an impulsive act with a positive reward, ultimately, because of that adaptation, becomes compulsive behavior with negative consequences. And it's the physical adaptation of the brain that makes us powerless over alcohol. And admitting helplessness is the first step out of the 12. Remember that it's the prefrontal cortex where decisions are made, but it's the nucleus accumbens that's the interface between emotions and action. That's where craving behavior originates. And when we're in the middle of craving, the nucleus accumbens is firing flat out. And if we don't get what we're seeking, dopamine crashes. We feel anxious and agitated, quite unhappy. Chemicals from the mesolimbic system, or the reward system like dopamine, serotonin, and cephalins and GABA all work together to cause the release of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens. And it's that release of dopamine that gives us pleasure. That's what we seek over and over and over again. So why doesn't everyone get addicted? Well, it's partly to do with the availability of the alcohol or the substance and the frequency at which we're exposed to it. And then the other part of the story is genetics. There are a handful of genes that result in low brain levels of dopamine in general, or low dopamine in response to drugs or substances. And these genes make impulsive, compulsive, and addictive behaviors more likely. That's been coined the reward deficiency syndrome. But be aware that genes contribute only 50 to 75% of this phenomenon. Our environment makes up 30 to 50%, partly because those genes can be switched on and off by our behaviors. That's what we call epigenetics. So drinking repetitively, even in moderation, sets people up for addiction by causing clear epigenetic changes at a cellular level. Now, back to the 12-step program and fellowship. It appears that the program causes the prefrontal cortex to talk to the addiction center, the nucleus accumbens. In other words, reason is introduced as a governor for the reward center. It would be interesting to see if the fellowship aspect of the program causes gene expression to change. Studies in animals shows that a nurturing environment reduces stress hormones and alters gene expression when a mother rat is very nurturing to her baby compared to removing the baby. And I suspect the same happens in a support group. Now, the 12-step program has a strong spiritual foundation. For example, step 11 reads, "Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out." You see, prayer and meditation increases the release of dopamine at the synapse between nerve cells. And when we make those habits daily, that keeps that dopamine flowing. The knock-on effect will be a proliferation of dopamine receptors in the brain to counteract some of those genetic predispositions and thereby reducing the risk of relapses. As one study put it, positive meditative practices, positive psychology, that's gratitude, spiritual acceptance, love of others and of self, and taking inventory of ourselves one day at a time has been the secret of success for many.
Men, do you want to gain an extra 4 years while looking and feeling great? Researchers in Loma Linda, California found the answer. For men, thinner is better, particularly as you age. The Adventist Health Study looked at men aged 75 to 99 and found the thinner men lived about 4 years longer. A healthy weight, even past the seventh decade of life, made a difference. Maintaining a healthy weight for your entire life is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time for your questions. David asks, if I go totally vegan, what's the best way to go about it? Will I need to take supplements to ensure adequate nutrition? Well, David, the best way to make transitions of any kind is actually to be informed. So know what you're doing, plan ahead, and then do it slowly. Look at how to swap out the animal products from your favorite foods to start with. So how are you going to replace them and still enjoy your food? And have fun with new foods. Be sure that you're eating whole foods rather than processed foods. You could even use Dr. Greger's Daily Dozen app. It gives you a daily guide to see if you're getting an ideal diet, getting enough of the different things that would make up a healthy diet. And then remember, Dr. Joel Fuhrman calls the whole food plant-based diet a nutritarian diet to keep the focus on the nutrients in the food. He says we should have G bombs every day. That's G for greens, B for beans and legumes, O for onions, M for mushrooms, B for berries, and S for seeds and nuts. The nutrients that you will need to supplement would be vitamin B12, 1,000 micrograms a day, and vitamin D, 2,000 units a day. Here's our next question. I have COPD and I'm trying to lose weight. What should I do? Having lung disease will obviously limit your ability to do much exercise. However, eating plenty of fruits and vegetables that have been shown to reduce the impact of COPD can actually do some healing of your lungs, and that may increase your exercise tolerance and allow you to do a bit more activity. Try to eat at least 8 servings of fruit and vegetables a day. Limit your fat intake and drink only water or unsweetened herbal teas. Consider supplementing with a good antioxidant, and one of my favorites is turmeric, because that may also help with the healing of your lungs. Robert asks, what is the best cooking oil when you're frying and which ones should be avoided? This is a great question. The best cooking oils are those with more polyunsaturated or monounsaturated fats, in other words, less saturated fat. So I recommend extra virgin olive oil for lower temperature sort of frying. And maybe if you're baking or using a high heat, use a vegetable oil that can handle that heat. That might be organic cold-pressed canola oil, grapeseed oil, rice bran oil, or even avocado oil. The ones not to use are the saturated fats, like I tend not to use too much coconut oil, lard, butter, those kinds of things. Now, if you have a question, remember, you can send it in by Facebook, text, email, or phone. Like us on Facebook to become part of our Go Healthy for Good community. Now let's see what's in the store today.
Celery is a winter crop with a mild aromatic taste. It's perfect for soups and casseroles because it adds a delicate flavour. It also works well with onions and carrots. Compared to other veggies, celery is high in sodium with 90 milligrams in one cup. But who eats a cup of celery? That's still less than the daily amount of 2,300 milligrams. Many people use celery as a weight loss snack because one cup only contains 20 calories. It has several B vitamins which are good for dealing with stress, and celery seed, which is sold as a spice, contains a compound that lowers blood pressure. Now, to avoid it wilting, you can keep celery well wrapped. However, if it does wilt, just trim the end and set it in a bowl of ice cold water. Pretty soon it's sitting up crunchy and crisp again. Keeps in the refrigerator for up to 7 weeks, and during that time the inner stalks here will continue to grow. Now that's what I call live food, perfect for juicing. Bon appetit. Today's expert guest is a nutritionist, prolific author, and international speaker. In the last segment, she shared how at 11 years of age she was doing drugs, smoking, and had an eating disorder. Here's more from Vicki Griffin.
My escape was books and libraries. It was an escape from chaos. And I did run away from home for good when I was 17 years old. And I ran away to Canada. And I will tell you, Narita, there are bad people out there. And I was with those bad people and was taken advantage of by those people. And I didn't realize how bad I was myself. But I was. When I found out my mother was dying of cancer, I came back home to take care of her.
How old were you at that point? How long were you gone?
I was gone. I was 18 when I came back. And I came back to take care of her. My grades had been so excellent that even running away from home didn't keep me from graduating. I don't know why. I cannot explain it.
Except God.
I'm sure of that because I was... I had an eating disorder. I was throwing up a dozen times a day. I was about 25 pounds thinner than I am right now, plus using drugs. And so if it were not for the restorative power of God, I would say, why not just give it up and go to the donut shop and forget it? But God's recuperative powers in every area of our lives are so fantastic and so amazing, and our very biology and engineering validates that we are, that the heart of health is really hope. And without hope, people have no desire to recover. And at that point in my life, I had no hope. Mm. And hope is really what we need. It's not even about so much information as it is hope. Hope is the foundation of even wanting to move forward. And at that point in my life, I didn't have that. But I came home to take care of my
mother. Now, how did you... I can't imagine the fortitude that would have taken to come back into an environment where you put yourself at risk for pain and the anger. I can't imagine the anger that you were dealing with.
I was. It was my personality. It was a part of my personality at that point.
Oh,
and
sure.
I did live at home during my high school years, but I kept leaving until I ran away for good. And so this was the pattern that I had established. This was the way I was facing problems these days, is you just drop and run or fight. And these are not good tools for navigating through life.
With that skill set, as we might say, you then came back to face the battle. How did you deal with coming back into it and dealing with that anger? And
that skill set and a car was pretty handy. So I came back to take care of her. I'm very thankful that in my core, she was still my parent. And I had an obligation, and no one else was there to take care of her. There was no one else. And so I'm so thankful that I made that choice. And so I worked. I took her to her appointments, and I was doing the right thing. And there is something healing about doing the right thing. I was still very out of control in my personal life. I could not control my eating. Every day I would say, you are not going to do this. But every day I did. And so anyone out there that has experienced this type of compulsion understands what I'm talking about. Well, there was a turning point.
Can I just ask... For a lot of us, an eating disorder is foreign. Mm-hmm. So if you could just explain, what is it about it that brings relief or that helps to feel better?
Well, people...
Because it's similar to cutting.
It is. It's like a personality disorder that develops. It's a compulsion, an obsessive compulsive behavior. It's an addiction. So what may begin as medicating a bad mood with some food, you add to that a highly restrictive diet that is very low in fiber and nutrients. So there's the physical satiety or satisfaction that you are not receiving because you are not taking in enough dietary fiber. So you're losing satiety there. And then you're losing nutritional satiety. So at every level, physical and at the cellular level, you are becoming malnourished. And because you now are on extremely low energy, there are biologic shifts that are occurring that are very, very powerful, which drive those addictions. So now, not only are you dealing with a mental health issue, you are also dealing with a very powerful biologic shift that has occurred in the brain and the body. You are drinking sweetened drinks that activate appetite signaling. There are peptides in the stomach that activate I am hungry signaling. And then you chase it with maybe some high fat food. Even if you're throwing up, it still signals, it dials down leptin, which would be, when it's dialed down, the I am satisfied signaling doesn't turn on. So you have an eating pattern that is driving compulsive overeating and hunger. When your basal metabolic rate drops because you have no energy to move because you're not taking in enough calories, mm-hmm. Now you're in an energy conservation mode. So eating very little causes weight gain. So there are these powerful reinforcing biologic shifts that occur that confuse the brain-body system. The lack of fiber and using all the sweetened, sugary foods then for energy, that even changes the microbiome in the GI tract. And so now dopamine levels are lowering, serotonin levels are lowering. And serotonin is a neurotransmitter that is also associated with learning. So the ability to learn, dopamine, which has to do with pleasure, GABA, which has to do with impulse control, all of these things are shifting and dialing down in the GI tract as well as the brain. So what began as an emotional thing now has become a condition that needs to be treated. And I believe we need to fight the battle at every level, social, spiritual, biologic, brain, environmental, and culture. It brings us right back to what we were talking about.
Biological shifts that must be fought on all fronts, as Vicky mentioned in the first segment. In the environment around us, the culture that pressures us, the biology that changes us, the brain that drives us, and the spiritual heart that leads us. Find out what happened next in Vicky's story right after the break. Charles was obese with high blood pressure, high blood sugars, high cholesterol, severe back pain meant he walked with two canes or a walker, and he suffered from depression. Then his doctor gave him the choice of prescriptions or lifestyle change, and he took the high road. Here's what happened. Watch.
I went from the 48-inch waist to the 32-inch waist. I feel really good about it, really good. At this time, I have no depression. My cholesterol levels are very good. I am not pre-diabetic anymore, and I am no longer hypertensive. And according to the nurse practitioner, after she took my blood pressure and my pulse, she took it two or three times just to clarify. She said that as far as she was concerned, I had the pulse of a 29-year-old athlete. Those are her words. If somebody was in my position, as I was at that time, I would say to them, you can do it. That the body is really a very, very wonderfully tuned machine. It's not a machine. It speaks to us. My body did speak to me. It was telling me on a daily basis what I needed to do. It's like I had a voice of its own, but I just had to listen to it. It's full of hope. It's full of faith. It absolutely can be done. It takes work. It really does take work. It takes a lot of work. It isn't a matter of getting up in the morning and meditating and then just eating cream puffs. It's a matter of getting up, having a vision of what you want to do, what you want to achieve, and then setting out to do that, little by little. Not all. It's not going to happen overnight. This has been a 5-year journey for me, and I intend to continue it.
After chiseling off 106 pounds, it makes all the sense in the world to keep them off. Today's guest had emotional trauma from years of abuse that triggered a compulsive eating disorder. Here's Vicky Griffin with her story of victory.
My mother passed away, but before she did, I was taking her to a treatment, and I passed a complex of buildings on the outskirts of town where we lived. And I noticed the landscaping, and the landscaping was very beautiful, and I've always loved the beauty of nature in spite of all the nastiness in my life. And I remembered it, and I mentioned it to a friend of mine. I said, you know, there's this venting, roofing, air conditioning complex of buildings. It must be some sort of construction company. It's called Seventh-day Adventist. They have so-so buildings, but beautiful landscaping. And my friend, who was familiar with Seventh-day Adventists, said, no, that's not a construction company. That is a university. And I remember like it was yesterday saying to her, well, anyone that landscapes like that can't be all bad. I think I'll go there. And that was the only reason. And I was a hardened atheist.
And you wanted
time.
To go there for education.
I wanted to work on grounds. I liked their landscaping. There was no other reason. But God had a reason for attracting my attention to this landscaping. And so my friend said, well, you'll probably be interviewed because you're not a Seventh-day Adventist and you're an atheist. So I don't know how they would deal with you, but I know how you can get in.
Really?
If you tell them that the body's a temple, they'll let you in. She was not a practicing Christian, but she knew that much. And with that bit of information, I applied. And I went in for an interview with the president of the university. And I remember, like it was yesterday, sidling up to the president of the university. And I said, you know, I don't know too much about you people, but I really like the idea that the body's a temple. And he put his arm around me and gave me a nice, friendly hug. And he said, I wish we had more young people like you on this campus. And I remember thinking to myself, because by then I was a real operator, and you know how to navigate around. And people with addictions may see themselves as victims, but they're pretty smart. And they know how to manipulate. And I had learned that well by now. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, if the head of the organization is this naive, I wonder what the rest of them are like. And I was in. And I met my husband there, my future husband. And he was a backslidden Christian. So he liked me. And it wasn't too long before we fell in love and became engaged and married.
Now, and where was the bulimia at this time?
I was still very bulimic. I hid it from him.
Oh, wow.
I was bulimic from age 11 to age 31 for 20 miserable years. Now, I had stopped when I adopted the lifestyle and the tenets that I believed. I left a lot of the lifestyle things, but I did not really know Jesus Christ personally. And that was what I was needing. That's what I was searching for. And God knew that. And he led me in a path so that it wasn't very long before I found Christ as a deliverer, not just a concept. And the power of that addiction was broken. And then I was given the tools for moving forward. And within 6 months of finding Christ, my husband and I found him together. We were in full-time ministry for 28 out of the 32 years of our marriage.
Wow.
Yes. He rests in the grave now. Mm. He is deceased. But I am so very grateful for the strength and courage that God has built into my thinking and into my lifestyle and into my approach to living that has completely transformed my ability to navigate through these troublous days.
Amen. So what happened to your anger? Because we talked about that.
Well,
when did that go?
I was searching for justice. And so I had a degree in social work. I did child abuse investigations. I received a $5,000 fellowship to law school. I was going to put everybody in jail. I worked for a finance company, and I repossessed cars and skip traced on bad checks. I was going to control everything and make everything right, but I couldn't control myself. And
well, that's so often the case,
yes,
isn't it?
That search for justice ended up in me recognizing that I was in need of mercy. And so when I found the big one in the room, which is God, he is the one that is just. He is the one that will make things right. And when I understood that, and when I understood that payday is coming and that God can renew and restore and strengthen that which is lost and broken, then I had the tools that I needed to leave justice in God's hands, not my own.
The best place to leave justice. If you're on the path of addictions, you are not alone. Millions have similar issues, and the big one in the room really is God. He's a God who wants to renew, restore, and recover all that is lost and broken in your life. In this four-part series with Vicki, you'll learn how to outsmart your compulsion by changing your environment, your culture, your biology, your brain, and your understanding of God. That's all for me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. And be sure to join Vicki and me for part 2.